My name is Glyn Edwards. I was born 7 Church Street, Rothwell, and I've been a roddler all my life. My dad's name was John. He was the second youngest of about 7 brothers and sisters. His father, Henry Edwards, was a well-known shopkeeper in Rothwell. My dad's brothers started one of the first bus services in the area. That was Uncle Sid, the eldest brother. He ran the bus service from the halfway house at Robin Hood to Swillington and ran that for quite a few years before they were bought out by one of the bigger bus services. This was during the 1930s. Sid was what you might call the magnate of the family. He was into farming. He'd fields down in Woodlesford in the All Saints, where the All Saints estate is now. It fields down the Robart sheds, also in the Carlton area, so he was quite well known and had a grocer's shop in the street. To be quite honest, I don't know a great deal about the family history. They were connected with a family called Parrots, who were well-known builders in the Metley area, because there was some money inherited at one stage during my lifetime from the death of the senior of the Parrots. So there must have been fairly well-connected people at that time. My mother was the eldest daughter of Tom Nunn's. 4 brothers and 3 other sisters, that's right.
And what was your mum's name, sorry?
Eliza. My mother's dad, Tom, worked at Swithin's Colliery, which was locally known as Tatey Main. The reason it was known as Tatey Main is because it was so shallow that when they were working the seam, they could pick the taties from, you know. Pip was badly affected by the 1921 strike, the 13-week strike, and I think the pumps were turned off and the pit was flooded and never reopened. But it was only a very, very minor pit. It was originally sunk by the Charlesworth, J&J Charlesworth, then sunk to the Hagmore seam, which was at that point only about 50 yards deep. When they relinquished the lease to the Hagmore seam, the pit was sold to Henry Briggs. So from, I don't know, possibly 1910 onwards, it was owned up to the closure, it was owned by Briggs. And when the pit closed, my grandfather moved across to Waterhead Colliery, which of course was another of the Briggs collieries.
So how did you get involved with the mining industry?
Yeah, well, really it was by accident. I'd originally hoped to start a job with an architect, but didn't get the necessary GCE passes that I wanted, the O-level passes that I wanted. And to some extent, out of desperation, I went down to Waterhead just to see if there were any jobs in the offices there. First place I went was into the time office, and talking to them, they said, "Oh, well, with the passes that you've got, you ought to be having a word with Bob Moss, the surveyor upstairs." I had a chat with Bob. He put me onto who to contact at area offices. I applied to them, and they were due to start a round of interviews more or less then, so I was asked to go for the interview. I was fortunate in the sense that I was offered a job at the pit that I'd sort of touted for, if you like, as an apprentice mine surveyor, a dog's body in the surveyor's office.
And how long would that apprenticeship be for?
There would be 3 years up to the ordinary national certificate level, and then 2 years at higher national certificate level, which took you through the written part of the examination, and then there was a practical examination once you'd got the HNC in mine surveying.
Your first day at work, what was that like?
I can't remember a great deal about it, to be quite honest. I was taken into the baths, shown where to put my clothes, because I'd been told in advance to get some, get the necessary pit clothes, provided with a helmet, belt and such. I think at that time the lads went down the pit about 10 o'clock. So I was sort of showing around the office, giving a drawing pen and a pencil, and told to do a bit of tracing and such until it was time to go down the pit. Then we got changed into pit clothes, went across to the lamp room, provided with a lamp, and down the mine. Prior to starting at Waterhaig, but to go to Whitwood Colliery to the training centre there. So I had a fortnight at the training centre at Whitwood Colliery. Strangely enough, a young man who had been in the same class as me at Rothwell Grammar School started on the same day as me. He was appointed to Primrose Hill Colliery. And we went to Whitwood, the Whitwood Training Centre together, and did the fortnight or so introduction, if you like, to going underground at the training centre before starting at the colliery.
And on your first day, though, at Waterhaig, did you go underground?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, because that was the norm. It was only a small surveying team. There was the Bob Moss unit surveyor, his deputy, and then two apprentices.
So can you just explain what the surveyor did in the colliery, what your jobs were about?
The main aim of the surveyor is to map the workings, make sure that the workings are going where they're intended to go, keep a record, a plan record of where they are, and basically to ensure that the workings don't go where they shouldn't go, that is towards other dangerous workings. That's really the main purpose of the surveyor. A lot of other duties, ancillary duties, but that the main one is to map the workings.
And how do you do that?
Well, by means of theodolites, the dumpy level, to record the level of the workings, but basically to do what the Ordnance Survey do on the surface.
And how is it possible to do that underground? Because you don't have the same points of reference, do you?
Well, no, going back historically, the workings were recorded using a magnetic compass, if you like, which is a little bit crude, but nevertheless, they were quite refined magnetic compasses. In more recent times, the wires were suspended down the shaft. They were surveyed from the surface, from Ordnance Survey reference points. The wires were suspended down the shaft, and then from those wires, surveys run out from the wires into the workings, and it could, it's possible to relate them to Ordnance Survey National Grid.
So when you started them, were you still using compasses?
No, that was gone by the board. A bit more refined than a compass, but that's the easiest way to describe it to a lay person.
So what kind of things were you learning to do then as an apprentice?
Well, to use the surveying instruments, the theodolite, the dumpy level.
Sorry, the what level?
The dumpy level, the spirit level, for recording the level of the workings. And generally the office procedure, the drawing instruments in the office.
You tell me if I've got this right. So you went down the pit with your pencil and your notebook and the spirit level and other bits of equipment. Yeah. You took measurements and then you went back up to the office to make out the plans. Is that how it works?
That's basically it. It's a little bit sketched over, but yeah, that's basically the way in which things were carried out.
What was it like down the pit?
If you turned a light out, it was a blackness that is totally indescribable. It is absolute blackness. You could put your finger to your nose and you wouldn't, until you touched it, you wouldn't know it was there. Or someone else could do that until they touched your nose and you wouldn't know it was there. Absolute total blackness. In some places, absolute total quiet. In other places, absolute total bedlam. And particularly if you went into a roadway that was being driven by compressed air drill, the noise from that, absolutely mind-numbing. In fact, you end up being totally disorientated. The noise and vibration is so great. And of course, this is one of the reasons why people suffer from ear problems and, you know, vibration, white finger, and all that type of thing.
Were you frightened when you first went now?
No, not particularly. No. I think I've only been frightened on one occasion, and that was when we do a survey through a coal face that had collapsed and been reopened. Where you were following the coal cutting machine through when everything was started to bump and bang, and that was the only time I felt apprehensive. Otherwise, I've never felt any particular fear down the mine.
Take me back to the surveying work itself then. So remind me, just explain what that principal job was once you were down and you were surveying.
The main work that we did was extending drivage lines so that the roadways were being driven in the direction that we wanted them to go. This had to be done pretty frequently. Of course, quite often you were in ground that was moving, so it had to be checked and realigned. So that was one of the major functions, particularly as an apprentice. You were a sort of glorified linesman.
And what was a typical coal face like then? How was it laid out?
It evolved over the years, but at the time I started, a coal face could be perhaps 200 yards long, with one roadway in the middle, which would be the loader gate where the coal was brought out, and then another roadway at each end of the face, which were the tailgates, which were the other access for materials and ventilation. But at that time, it was all hand-filling. There were conveyor belts on the face directed in two directions towards the middle gate. The coal was loaded onto the by shovel, transported to the middle gate, where it was transferred to another conveyor belt to be taken down the gate to the loading point, where it could be loaded into tubs.
So once you'd started a new coal face, how far away from the bottom of the pit would these faces be?
The furthest working when I was there was some 2.5 miles from the pit bottom. In fact, from Warthag at Woodlesford, we walked, now then, to get to that, and I'm just trying to think where we would go, under the where the sports centre is now, out under the golf courses, right the way across to Oslo Green, across there. So, yeah, it's quite a distance out from the pit bottom. And at that time, there wasn't any man riding. So it had to be walked sort of 2.5 miles each way, which wasn't so bad for us, because we then just had to do a bit of surveying up there. But for the collier, it had a 2.5 mile walk each way and a shift on his knees on the coal face.
And which seam was that?
That would be the Beeston seam.
And that was the Beeston seam the best seam in the pit?
No, the best seam had been one of the shallowest seams, the Hagmore seam. Then the Silkstone, which was mainly owned by Charlesworth, had the lease to most of that. And Briggs had the lease to the Beeston seam, which was quite a good quality seam and quite a thick seam, but not as good as the other two.
We've established that you've had a coal face out towards Uzzlewell Green. Which other directions did you go in?
There were coal faces under the Metley Park area, down towards Metley Woodrow area. We didn't go across to the Swillington side. We were all the Woodlesford Alton side of the railway and canal.
So you didn't mine underneath Alton and Woodlesford villages then?
Only partial extraction. Narrow faces leaving wide pillars of coal to support the village, but of course not under the churches.
So there were all sorts of rules about where you could go then, were there?
Not so much rules, but you bear in mind that if you cause subsidence damage, you have to pay for the damage. So the coal owners wouldn't want to be paying compensation for surface damage, so they would take care to leave pillars of coal where they were going to be, you know, where they were going to incur high cost, and simply extract all the seam out in the fields, if you like.
So, for instance, the big houses in the area, the Alton Halls, the Metley
Hall.
All
the church places such as that, all that pillars of gold.
And it was part of your job to understand where these buildings were on the surface.
Yeah, well, this is why we everything had to be related to Ordnance Survey, National Grid, so that everything was correlated in that way. At the time I started at Waterhay, we were working another seam, the Flockton Thick Seam, in the Metley area, and had to leave a pillar of coal for Metley Hall. But subsequently, it was decided that Metley Hall was redundant. The place was demolished, and the coal that had been left to support the hall was left in the ground. So, you know, it was just a sort of a wasted effort. And in fact, we could have demolished the place for them if they'd allowed us to work the seam underneath it.
And going back to this picture of how a coal face worked, as the face advanced away from the bottom of the pit, there was this thing called a gob. Tell us more about how that worked.
Well, this was simply the ground that was allowed to collapse behind the face. All that you're interested in supporting in the mine is the immediate area, 10 feet, if you like, from the coal face back. Everything behind that is allowed to collapse. Where the roadways are, there are packs put on alongside the roadways to help to support the roadways, but everything then otherwise is allowed to collapse behind you. The best way I can describe it is that if you were to dig a hole and throw the material back into the hole, you'd find that you'd have some material left over, unless you packed it really, really tight. So when you take the coal seam out, you might have a thickness of 4 or 5 feet, depending on the thickness of the seam, 4 or 5 feet of space left behind you. But perhaps 10 or 15 feet of the immediate roof behind that you're not supporting will collapse. And that collapsed material will fill that space. It's a ratio of about 1.5 to 1. So because you filled most of that space up with loose material, the rock above will then settle down gently and come down gently. You don't get a collapse right the way through to the surface.
Right, so when you're advancing the face then, you're putting waste material into the gob all the time?
You're allowing it to collapse behind you all the time. I mean, it may well be that there are situations where some of the cuttings aren't worth sending out, so that could be thrown back into the gob. But the majority of gob material is what's the immediate roof that's collapsed and filled the space up.
So that process of the roof falling into the gob was all part of the natural way in which the mining worked. That wasn't a problem for you as such?
No, it was a planned situation. Quite often what would happen is that in order to control the rate at which the gob came down, they might put on what were known as strip packs, stone packs with the areas of waste between, so that you allow that the gob to come down at a controlled rate.
And were there men whose job it was specifically to work on that part of the process?
Yeah. I mean, during hand filling days, it was a cycle of operations. The seam would be undercut by a core cutting machine, so you'd have a team of men working, taking the core cutting machine through the face, doing the 200 yards core cutting. That you would then have the team of colliers coming on who would fill the coal out. You'd have the shop firers, of course, who would fire the coal. The coal would be filled out on the conveyors. Normally, you would have the coal cutters coming in after the face has been filled off. And then once the coal had been undercut again, you would have the salvage men coming in, putting on the strip packs, withdrawing the supports that were nearest to the gob to allow the gob to collapse. And of course you'd have the rippers coming in to advance the roadways.
And how long would it take, once you'd got to a setup where you were undercutting the coal and then shot firing it, how long would it take to do that whole 200 yards?
Well, normally it would be a shift job to undercut a 200-yard face would be a shift job. So you'd have the 24-hour cycle. that was the colliers, the machine men, and the salvage men on a 24-hour cycle.
And then the face would advance by 6 feet or
five,
so?
5 feet normally.
Every 24 hours?
Every 24 hours, yeah.
Because you were a surveyor and you had compasses and all the other equipment that you talked about, you would know...
The theodolite was one of the main... The dial, the miner's dial, and the theodolite were the main instruments.
But you would know where you are all the time.
Yeah.
Did the miners know where they were underground in relation to what was on the surface?
Not unless you told them. They'd have a general idea that they were in the Methley or the Carlton or the Alton area, but they wouldn't know specifically where they were. It was up to the surveyor, if you like, to tell them where they were.
How did things change in the period that you were at Waterhague? Take us through from your apprenticeship into the 1960s. What were the events that you can remember about how things changed, moved along?
Well, I suppose one of the main things was that when I started, all the faces were hand-filled, machine-cut, hand-filled. By the time I left there in 1966, I think all of the faces were being cut by a shearer or something like that. In fact, there was no hand-filling. All the coal was being loaded onto a mechanical conveyor by a machine.
So there was a lot of investment in machinery during your period then?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, I mean, it wasn't for the benefit of the men. It was simply to reduce the cost of output.
Presumably there was a subsequent reduction in the workforce.
When I started, I think there were about 1,250 men there, and by the time I'd left, it was probably down to about 700 for a similar sort of output, probably a bit of a reduction in output, but not a proportionate reduction. So there was an improvement in output per man shift. That was one of the criteria, the OMS, output per man shift.